This is more of a sermon than a teaching session, although it's both. Some time ago, I brought a message from a book called In His Image. I did a quick bit of reading from this doctor of worldwide renown, a Christian doctor, about how the body was made. And a sequel has been written to that book. And this morning in the Sunday school hour and also in the morning hour, preaching hour, I'm going to be reading from that book and be explaining more of what God has made us to be. I've entitled this first lesson, How Great is God and His Creation? And reading from the book of Psalms in the chapter 139, verse 14, this very well-known passage. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. Our soul should know how marvelous God's work is in us. We should not live under a demonic response that we are zero, zilch, nothing. We should always know that we are sinners saved by grace. But we should know that after having been saved by grace, that we are sons of God. And that we were created to be not only in His image, but in His likeness. And we're created to be, have dominion over the earth. And to be in high esteem in God's sight. And the devil has wanted to keep God's people from recognizing the greatness of God's creation in them. And therefore the world has come up with a doctrine of evolution to take the glory away from God. And there are demons that make Christians want to brag in some aspect, but then demean themselves as nothing. And using the bragging to hide the demeaning. Well, really, we should have humility showing forth the recognition of our greatness in God and before Him. The first book, someone says, I think was called Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. That's probably right. The second one is called In His Image by Dr. Brand. Now, the Hebrew, according to Carolyn DeLisk, in this verse says, I will give thanks unto thee that I have wonderfully come into being under circumstances exciting a shudder of astonishment. And that isn't some antique phrase because of the ignorance of man at that time. That was given under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit to David. But as I read to you this morning in both sessions, you're going to see that indeed this body, just the body part of it, to say nothing of the soul and the spirit, which is infinitely greater, just the body part of it is marvelous indeed, more than we ever imagined. I want to read one more scripture, Jeremiah 27 and verse 5. It says, I have made the earth, the man and the beast that are upon the ground, by my great power and by my outstretched arm, and have given it unto whom it seemed meet unto me. I have given the air and the sea and the land to whomsoever I have wished and whatsoever I have wished. And I have decided what nations or where, and I can lift up and pluck down. I've decided who lives where. I've decided what languages to give and the dispersion of Babel, and where to have them move off to. It is I that have decided all these things. And if I want to take from someone who has not paid the rent to God and have another come in and occupy that space, that's my business. For I am God and I own all things. That's what he's saying. Now, there are 5 trillion chemical operations occurring in the human brain every second. Now, when we say trillion, we really don't know what that means. We know how to write it, but we cannot conceive of it. To help you conceive of it, let me give you two examples. 5 trillion sheets of typing paper stacked up, every one of them being in operation, you'd have to stack up that typing paper to 1/7 of the distance to the moon to be 1 trillion sheets. That's a lot of action. Or to put it another way, if a grain of sand is 1/50th of an inch in diameter, that'd be a small, medium grain of sand. 5 trillion grains of sand, if you take them one at a time, one little speck at a time, lining 50 of them up this way to make an inch and 50 this direction, and then you have to fill in all those spaces. That's just the first layer. Now you're starting on your second layer. And if you did that, 5 trillion operations of these grains of sand would fill 25 bedrooms to the ceiling with sand, each bedroom being 10 foot by 12 foot by 8 foot high. We're talking about big numbers. We're talking big, you know what I mean? Yet in the human brain, in this little human brain, there are 5 trillion chemical operations per second. Now this coming from a protoplasm in a pool, I don't believe. Let's say that you are lying on a hammock in the backyard in the summer on a lazy day. You're not downtown, but busy New York and lots of things happening, but just some lazy day where not much is happening. The brain is registering, identifying, cataloging, and reasoning over the sound of the lawnmower that is going out in the backyard. The type of mower, you can tell whether that is a cycle mower, whether it is a wheel mower, and if you're a good mechanic, you can tell more about the engine, and the smell of the gas oil mixture, your mind is aware of that. It's aware of the smell of the cut grass. It's aware of the interruptions of the mower, the choking and the interruptions. It's aware of the sound blades hitting the rock, and you're aware of also who is running the mower, because you know that. And your mind is aware of the smell and the sound both of a dog sniffing around. And even though you're not consciously aware, your mind is aware of all these things and registering it. You're aware of the sound of a baby crying and a recall of who's with the baby and some concern over the baby's safety as you hear him squalling there in the kitchen. And your mind runs down quickly, runs down a list of various things that might be of danger to the baby. Your mind is aware of the story of the book that you're reading, and the sound of the turning of the pages, and the smell of the new paper, and the calculations of the time left basically to finish the book, how long do you get done, the feel of the weight of the book in your hand, you're aware of that. The mind is registering decisions of the most comfortable way to hold the book as you're lying there in your hammock. And you're evaluating the author of the book and the style, and you're feeling the emotions of the story, you're identifying with the characters, you're keeping track of the book marker and the slipping cover, and your awareness of the glare of the sun on the book, and you are calculating at the right focus to hold the book, and you're aware of your weight in the hammock and of your body motion in the hammock and certain discomfort in the hammock, your awareness of the pillow in the hammock, and the inputs of the body periodically, crossing of the legs, shifting posture, all these things are going on. Your awareness of the mosquito's buzz out here, and the fear of the mosquito puncturing your skin and injecting its poison. You're aware of the locations, whereabouts he is. You're aware of the irritation you receive at his presence. You're aware of the sound of the wife fixing lunch in the kitchen. And you're aware of the feeling of hunger and the smell of food from the kitchen wafting out. You're aware of and identifying the smell of bread and of the different foods. You're aware of the identification of the voices in the houses, awareness of the cars in the street, out past in the front, and the various sounds, identifications, cycles, buses, different kind of cars, and the shifting of the gears and so forth, squeezing of the tires. You're aware of your body temperature, decisions for whether you want a fan or whether you want a sweater you want to drink, you're aware of the glass, the straw, the feeding, the coolness, you're aware of the bird songs, you're aware of the cat slinking out the corner of your eye, you're aware of a concern for the bird, also for the flowers, you're aware of the aroma of the flowers, and your awareness if you need to empty your bladder and blow your nose. And this is not a dull day. This is a day with nothing happening. And this is only a few of the brain functions. And this does not include body conversions to chemicals, body temperature controls, gastric juice controls, and so forth and so forth and so forth. And you have all these things happening up in your brain and a great deal more. And our ears are picking up air molecules, moving and vibrating so slightly that they move the eardrum only 1/10,000th of a centimeter. Now that's only 1/100th of the thickness of a piece of bond paper. Only 1/100th is only moving the tympanic membrane that much, and you're registering sounds from something that slight. Our ear is so flexible, our hearing is so flexible that we can hear a pin drop. We also can hear a New York subway, which is 100 trillion times louder than a pin dropping, without any discomfort. We also can hear things much louder than that, like a bomb exploding right close. The three bones that make up the ear, the anvil, the hammer, and the stirrup, are the smallest bones in the body, and they're fully developed all at birth. They don't grow like the rest of the bones of the body. And they magnify sound 20 times more than when they enter the ear by sending out the signal. Molecules of air, of moving air, are transferred as they come into the little drum in there to this mechanical device, the hammer and the anvil and the stirrup, sending up sound waves that transfer to a heavier fluid, heavier than air, to the gas of the air. Now it transfers to a fluid which is heavier and increases the vibrations in a seismic chamber, transferring from there to electrical impulse through thousands of neurons, or we may call wires. If then on, it's not air vibrations at all, or even fluid vibrations. Now it's going in up through wires to 20,000 to thousands of neurons to register the vibration code signatures on the brain, which then searches for an identical code signature and determines the source and the class of the sound. Or if it is a brand new signal, there's no identification, if the body feels the cause, scratching with your fingernail or something, or if the eyes see the cause, it sets up a whole new classification in your mind for that code signal. And so you get all these molecules vibrating at all these different frequencies, and you're identifying every one of these as to what they are. Molecules vibrating at 256 times per second is identified as middle C, or at least as an unidentifiable sound different than other notes if you don't know what middle C sounds like. Now, the average person can detect vibrations from 20 to 20,000 cycles per second. That's a lot of variations. Inside the sound chamber, 25,000 sound receptor cells line up to receive these vibrations and pass them on. 25,000 in each ear. And seen through an electron microscope, they look like rows of baseball bats sticking out, waiting to be struck by air molecules. And some of them fire off vibrations to the brain when 250 cycle vibrations, which is middle C, reaches them. Others fire off when other cycles, and they don't all fire off all the time when all cycles. Some of them are more heavily based, and they don't move at 250 cycles. They wait for 1,000 cycles, and these ones fire off different identifying codes. Others wait for different program frequencies, and the ear distinguishes 300,000 tones. And a full orchestra sets the bats a flying. See, we are really wonderfully made. Created by God. Now, demons can cause people with all this equipment not to function. And it isn't true that, although demons have various assignments, just like angels do, it's not true that A demon can only do one thing. It's not true, we can do more than one thing. It's not true that a demon of lust can only lust. Because, see, he is not a demon of lust because he is intrinsically a lustful demon. That is a misconception. For example, there are demons of drugs. These are fallen angels. They didn't have drugs in heaven. Are these different demons? They didn't have all those things in heaven. They weren't created that way. We had a demon one time through a person. I'm not sure what the demon was. But as we were coming against this demon, and this demon was arguing about through this person's mouth about coming out. I'm not leaving. And he was really setting up a big argument. And he was getting angry, and we were pushing him hard and calling for the Lord to send angels to war against him. And we were demanding in the name of Jesus that he goes, and he was arguing out of this person's mouth. And finally he said, I'm going to make him so he won't heal. And he made that person deaf. And there's nothing wrong with his ears, but he could not heal. Somehow he stiffened all those bats or something in there. And he blocked those neurons or something. Because we talked to him and we're trying to get to him. I'll call him Alex. I don't know who it was. Now, and we said, Alex, can you hear me? I'm talking to you. If you can hear me, nod your head. Alex, we kept talking and we said different things to him. We asked him to get a hold of your will, so forth. And we rebuked that demon. He said, well, he said you're going to make him deaf. It sounds like he is. And we rebuked him and we came against him. And finally, that thing left. And then we said to him, Alex, and he said, yes. He said, did you hear what we've been telling you? And he said, what? He said, we're telling you to this and this. And he says, no. Well, did you hear us say this and this? No. Well, did you hear us say this and this and this and this? Didn't you say that to you? No. And that demon said, we command that demon to leave. And he says, I'm going to make him bite his tongue. Hey, bit his tongue hard and blood started coming out. Finally, that demon screamed and left. See, that demon could make him deaf. Didn't have to call in a deafness demon, apparently. He can make him bite his tongue. I mean, they can interact on the body. Even though there's nothing wrong with them. And Jesus came against spirit of deafness, spirit of blindness. And when they left, they could heal. They could see. There was something blocking, something that was created. They were all right. Well, the Bible also talks about us, those having ears who cannot hear. There are those who got natural ears, and everything, and it isn't necessarily a misfunction. It isn't necessarily something intrinsically, congenitally wrong in the makeup of the ear. It may be a demon blocking it. We had a case of a girl up here, a 12-year-old girl. I was praying for those who had short legs and twisted backs and so forth. And one leg was shorter than the other, and one foot was turned in just like this. And before I prayed to have the Lord just lengthen this thing, I think it was twisted. I took this foot and went like this, and it moved. I took this foot like this, and it was rigid. I mean, just like it was iron. And I just felt by the Spirit to rebuke that thing before I prayed. And I just said, I rebuke you, Spirit, get out of here. I went like this. I took a hold of it and went like this. And we prayed, and it came on out. And then I thought, that filthy demon. All that time, she had that thing twisted, thinking, I got something wrong with me. When all she had was a demon cranking it in. And there are spiritual Christians. The only thing really wrong is they've got a demon on their mind so that their ears cannot hear what God is bringing to the pastor, to testimonies, to witnessing, by his Spirit, through prophecy, through his word or whatever. They cannot hear spiritually what is being said. There's a demonic force. Until that gets rooted out, they are locked into that frame of mind. There's a doctrine, a demon of that doctrine, or a frame of mind, or something. There is something there, some lying spirit, deceiving spirit. And as long as that thing is there, everything coming in is channeled some other way. And it always comes out this way. They cannot hear what's being said. We dealt with a group of people one time that had gotten to a frame of mind. And we had a meeting. And we had a few of them. And we had a few of us. Every single thing I said. They never understood. And they'd been a part of this body, but everybody we had understood. And they would say, well, now, are you saying, well, do you mean that? And that's why I said, now, how is it that every time I say something, and you've been right with me, you don't know what I mean? But every one time I ask, all of these know what I mean, and all of these don't know. You see, something is wrong. And we need to become aware of these things, and we need to have our safety in checking ourselves with others. And if everybody else is understanding and we'll never, there is something wrong. And it's a terrible mistake to say, well, they're just all wacky, my viewpoint. See, that's kind of a dangerous thing. There's a safety in understanding that we may be having a blockage someplace.
Right.
A spirit may be bothering us. Now, a bat emits and receives radar signals. It sends out a signal, receives it back, so it knows where it is in space, 5 times faster than the human ear can hear, guiding it through dark caves and jungles without ever hitting a thing by tremendously fast cycles. Owls have omnidirectional sound. So an owl, one ear of an owl points forward and one points back. And so that an owl can pinpoint the location of a mouse in the bushes or in the straw of a large barn with his eyes shut. He knows exactly where that thing is. We kind of, I think it came from this direction. Oh, it sounded like it was in back of me. But he knows exactly where it was. God has created everything to its own environment. We can even heal, and this is even something more amazing. We can even heal without our eardrums and hearing receptacles firing. Without the eardrum moving, without any of these bats firing off the signals, without any impulse going through the seismic chamber, without any molecules hitting our ear, we can heal. We can heal from our memory cells. Almost at will. We decide to heal what we once heard. Even in complex form, the signal code is in the brain, and every time we ask them, we say, Molly, start a song. We start, Paula, George, start this song, will you? How do they know how to start? They decide to heal one of these billions of sounds that have been already registered, and all these billions of things that are up here, all the things that are logged. They go through one of the 300,000 code signals, and they decide to heal. And they're not just hearing one sound, they're hearing hundreds of them making up this tune. And they say, well, just a minute. And they hear it in the mind, and off they go. And if I ask you right now, what is the tone of a fairy? Can you hear the fairy? Boop. Foghorn, or whatever it is, you know. Boop. Boop. You can hear that. How do you know what it sounds like? You have it registered. You can hear it in your mind. You can hear the tinkling of bells. You know the difference between tinkling of a bell, the hooting of an owl. You make these sounds for your children to teach them. You can hear at will. Nothing even striking. Hearing is in the brain. It is the result of all these other things coming in. I want to read you a little bit from this book. Smell, and now we're talking about smelling. Smell leaves the world of qualifiable physics and approaches mystery. Now get this one. Consider a moth who comes across just one molecule of a pheromone emitted by a mate 3 miles away. Just one molecule. He will not eat or rest until he finds the female who tantalized him. And one molecule per mile gives sufficient clues to track her down. That came from evolution? How do you get so much more highly adapted in that one thing than human beings who are so much more evolved? Or consider a salmon who leaves a river near Portland, Oregon, as a mere fingerling and voyages far out into the ocean, thousands of miles from home, without a map, without visual signposts, without any clue other than its sense of smell. Its receptors, bizarrely scattered in random sites all over the fish's squamous body, the adult salmon will find its way back to the stream of its birth. Amazing beyond all belief. You have to say God is past finding out. How would you design something like that? A boll weevil will attempt to mate soft fields of cotton all day long, passionately, when those fields are sprayed with his female scent. Just by smell, he's trying to mate this cotton if he sprays the cotton with his scent. He goes by smell. Most of us have far more capacity for smell than we ever exercise, except those few professionals whose livelihood depend on the tasting of wine or coffee or tea or smelling of incense or perfume. Were we forced to live in the wild and depend upon smell for survival, that dormant position of our brain would awaken, directing the relentless search for food and warning of the noxious odors of putrefaction, bitter poisons, and vile smoky vapors. Now, this is the same thing, and that's not an evolutionary statement. This is the same thing with balance. You've seen people walk wires and do tremendous balancing feats and tremendous coordination. It isn't that they start off doing that. You don't hand somebody 27 balls and he says, I've got good coordination. No. He takes two to start with. You develop it. We have much more potential to develop in smell or taste or any of the things we do. We don't take full advantage in any area. Same way with sight. I've done some flying with Terry Anderson, who's flown in over 400 missions in North Vietnam. And he spots, you have to keep watching, and he spots aircraft so fast in the horizon. And he says, as a fighter bomber pilot, you learn quickly to forget everything but what you're looking for. And so I've looked out over the horizon with him, looking at the airplanes, and I see clouds, sunshine on it. We see. And those things are making it more difficult to pick up the little tiny aircraft spot. But he's learned to look for aircraft. And so he sweeps the horizon, and he says, yeah, there's one coming in, and there's two over here. And he's spotting them because he's learned to look for them. Some of you hunters will recognize the same thing. You're used to looking for game. You'll find game, and the nine guys with you, they don't see anything but trees. Because you're used to looking for a certain thing, see. We can develop our sight. Same way with the memory. People that are blind have to develop the sense of touch and the memory to a higher degree than those who are not. My boy David, because he cannot write everything down like you can, he has to rely on memory. And he's got memories that put most of you to shame. You put most of all 12 of you and me combined to shame. For a long time, he knew practically every phone number in our phone book. He could just tell anybody his phone number, he rattled off. And besides that, he'll tell you the scripture, he'll tell you every gospel that's in. And this type of thing has got tremendous memory. It can be developed. Now, after saying that, I want to say this. It's the same thing in the spirit world with us human spirits. You can develop, we can exercise our spirits and develop spiritual awareness. To develop spiritual intimacy, or we can leave it kind of dull and undeveloped. We can exercise gifts of the spirit until we have excellent ability to understand what is of God and what isn't and how to exercise it. Or we can blunder with it because we haven't exercised it much and haven't been keen in our exercise. And if you try to exercise a gift and are not keen in it, you just feel something, so you speak it out and say, "Thus saith the Lord," and your mind is off of it, you'll never learn much. Until you're understanding how you're feeling, what's happening to you, the tone, the tenor of it, how it registers on the people, how it bears witness. Unless you're looking at all these things, you're not really learning from it like you should. And you're not exercising your gift like you should. You're not really learning, as the Scripture tells us, to in 1 Corinthians 14, to excel in the gifts, abound in them to the edification of the assembly. The same thing comes with exercising faith. If you don't trust God for much, then when times come you really need faith in God, it just isn't, it's not highly developed. It just isn't highly developed. But he that is trusting God for everything, then it's easy for him to trust God for other things when they come, because he's used to trusting God. It's the same thing with self-denial. If you never deny yourself much, and then something comes and you need to deny yourself, it's hard. And so you find yourself going to all kinds of spiritual battles to get your will under control, because your will is just a brat. See? It's never had to bring itself under control. But he who is constantly denying himself in these areas, and then he's called to deny himself here, he can steel himself and take a deep breath and say, okay, here goes another one. It's easier because he's been doing it all along the way. It's the same thing with resisting demonic power against you. If you're used to saying, resisting that demonic power, if you're used to calling on the Lord, it gets easier to do that because you have been doing that. It's the same thing with exercising power in Christ. You can begin to exercise power in Christ. You know, if you just keep yourself in a place of non-anointed dialogue, not in touch with God, not used to taking a hold of faith, exercising something, recognizing what His will is, taking control over it, believing it to be so, taking authority, then you don't have much authority. And then when you come in contact with demonic power, why, you have a tremendous battle to get through. But those who do, they can get through. This is why some people, they've gotten rid of, 25 spirits bothering them. Any manifestations didn't take long. They brought that thing under control. They decided, they shut them right off at the fountain. Others go months and can't seem to get deliverance because they won't shut it off. They can't get a hold of their will. They can't exercise that power. And we need to take advantage of that, understand that. Smell operates by direct chemical action. Tiny olfactory receptors perform elaborate chemical tests on any stray molecule that floats by. In Mars, fuzzy smell antenna work similarly to TV antenna by increasing the reception capability. In humans, a penny-sized patch of receptive tissue lies at the top of our nasal cavities. For a good analysis, we must sniff in to force the molecules up to the sensitive spot and then trapping them in the sticky moisture of the nasal lining. We can detect one garlic molecule in the waftage of 50,000 other molecules. This is why when you get all pronged up, potatoes smell like apples. You can't tell the difference, Nothing can get to that sensitive spot. The amount of substance needed to trigger smell defies belief. No DuPont laboratory can perform an analysis with 1/100th of the speed and accuracy of a bloodhound's nose. A detective holds a sock before the baleful dog. He sniffs deeply a few times, sorting out our stale cigarette smoke, the artificial odor of Dr. Scholl's foot pads, the complex history of a piece of leather, traces of bacterial action, and somewhere pieces of the man himself, the criminal. He finds the trails of the woods and shuffles along, snorting and evaluating. Suddenly a yelp. He has sniffed in another piece. The pine needles, the dust, the men around him, the thousand smells of the forest floor. None of these interfere with his singular determination to follow the one molecule structure imprinted on his brain. He will follow that spoor through creeks and swamps, across logs, down city sidewalks, up apartment stairs, wherever it leads, one day, 2 days, even a week after the criminal has left the telltale bits. I know no laboratory in the world that would agree to distinguish one human from another by analyzing bits of two socks, let alone track that smell through such conditions. When you see a dog run along a path 30 feet wide, back and forth a few times hunting for a smell, this is so amazing to me. It's just like that moth. They're picking up one molecule per mile hunting for the female. If some of you men would hunt that hard for a mate, you'd find one. But I just threw that in free. No extra charge for that. A coyote or a criminal or something passed by 2 or 3 days before. It may have been a bobcat running. And this bobcat running, do you know how long it took him to cover that 40 feet? Just about 3 seconds, or much less, just 2 or 3 seconds. That's all. And that dog, 2 or 3 days later, is trying to determine whether that footprint or that footprint is older, which one's older than the other by 2 or 3 seconds. It is so fantastically amazing. Amazing. And that's what's happening. See, we judge everything by ourselves and say, how can it be? Because we're not designed that way. We're looking at a creator, brother, who's big, past finding out. The nose is also an organ of nostalgia. The smell of coffee, a whiff of the briny seashore, the faintest lingering trace of a certain perfume, or the etheric odor of a hospital corridor can stop you like a bullet. You relive that former moment in a flash, jerked backward in time by the fragrance, locked away in your brain. All of a sudden you've got memory cells, and you can see again the shore. You can feel and hear the waves slapping. You can feel the ecstasy of that love under the moonlight. And all of a sudden, all those things are reawakened that is not happening right now. Now, see, this is, in a small sense, like the spirit world in which you can be transferred into spirit to another realm where you're not even there and see things where your spirit is here, like I talked about before and won't have time to qualify this morning. So you also, through these memory cells that God has set, can relive experiences that you've had years ago. And you can feel and begin to feel the emotions, you can begin to cry again over something that happened years ago and begin to heal and rehear the thing and see it in you and so forth. Without it even happening, you're projected to another realm. Now, if you can do that right here, let's be big enough to believe that God can do this thing in the spirit realm like we've been talking about. Yet, just a few days later, these overpowering sensations fade into barely noticeable background atmosphere. The brain faithfully squelches odors after an initial heightened period. Smell is primarily a centennial warning, and once warned, why should the brain be troubled with redundancy? Fish merchants, tanners, garbage collectors, and paper mill employees gratefully accept this mercy of habitation. You'll get used to it, they say, with total accuracy. So see, God has even not only created us, we can pick out these small things, smells, but if we're forced to live in the environment of these odors, then we can get used to it until it's not bothering us. He's made us highly adaptable. Certain phrases keep recurring in textbook descriptions of smell. Quote, difficult to explain, not yet determined. It is still not understood precisely how. We humans possess baffling powers capable of discriminating some 10,000 different odors. Now let's talk about taste. Taste relies mostly on smell, as any chef or eater with a stopped-up nose can confirm. An electronic microscope scan of the tongue's dense mat of taste buds reveals splendid structures, dramatic cliffs and caverns, cactus flowers, clusters of tall waving stalks, exotic leaves. They work well enough to afflict most of us with lavish appetites and insatiable cravings. But it takes 25,000 times as much of a substance to register on a stubby taste bud as it does to register on a smell receptor. And for some mysterious reason, taste buds live a mere 3 to 5 days, then die off. So the only experienced taste exists in the fortress of the brain. Consider this startling fact. When a patient is receiving food directly into the stomach or intravenously, the body will absorb more nourishment if the patient primes it by tasting food first. If you're working intravenously, you get more nourishment if you taste it first. The experience of taste stimulates the gastric juices in the same way the smell of a sizzling steak or frying bacon can awaken us with sudden unexpected hunger. He can speak for himself, though. Sight. The human eye's characteristic coloring comes, of course, from the iris, comprising radial and circular muscles that assist in opening and closing the pupil, thus increasing or decreasing the amount of light permitted by a factor of 16. A camera f-stop shutter duplicates this mechanical function, but nothing duplicates the lovely texture of those exquisite muscles that ripple and flute like the gills of a tropical fish, making up the iris. Inside a precision lens made of living tissue is slung with transparent projectors and kept in position by a clear liquid that renews itself constantly to re-nourish the cells and kill stray germs. In humans, 127 million cells, called rods and cones, line up in rows as the seeing elements that receive light and transmit messages to the brain. Rods, slender and graceful tentacles that reach out toward light, outnumber the bulbous cones 120 million to 7 million. These rod cells are so sensitive that the smallest measurable unit of light, one photon, can excite them. Under optimum conditions, the human eye can detect a candle at a distance of 15 miles. Yet with rods alone, we would see only shades of black and gray and would not get the focal resolution allowed by more complex cones. When you're talking about having 127 million rods and cones, you could not draw a circle the size of the back of your eye and poke 127 million pinpoints in there. It would not fit by a long ways. I mean, we're talking small. How are you making anything that small? Squeezed into the dense forest of rods and larger cones tend to concentrate in the precise. Squeezed into the dense forest of rods, the larger cones tend to concentrate in the precise spots in the eye where focusing is the most acute. Although cones are 1,000 times less sensitive to light, they make possible all perception of colors and fine details. The diversity of animal vision depends largely on the distribution of these two cells. Owls have far more rods to allow for superb night vision. In contrast, a chicken has only cones for detecting tiny insects. Beyond a certain range, a chicken is nearly blind. A common fly has 30,000 autonomous eye units, sometimes called individual eyes, 130,000 eyes, each one, complete in itself. Our assortment of rods and cones let us see objects at the ends of our nose and also star light years away. Now, the Lord talked about us having eyes that cannot see. And he said that the Laodiceans were blind, but didn't know it. You know, a bat doesn't know that he's, or a slug or whatever, he gets a creature that can't see much, or anything. He doesn't know that he's blind or nearly blind. I mean, that's normal. If he had a brain like ours, he would think it's fantastic that humans can see like they see. And yet we can't see at all like some creatures can see. We're living in a world that God has created that shows his glory and his power and his majesty. Now remember that when you want to argue with God. And want to remind God lest he forget. We're dealing with a power that is really something. Plato mistakenly believed that vision consisted of particles squirting out of the eye and falling on external objects. So some of these great philosophers of the world, they weren't really so smart, you know. At the back of the eye, in a coin-sized patch called the retina, the camera analogy becomes obsolete, for the actual physical image stops with the retina. From there on, everything is electricity. In effect, we do not actually see with the eye, but with the help of it. Our brains do not receive photographic images of anything. Rather, in some of the 127 million rods and cones excited by the light waves and fire off messages to the 1 million fibers of the optic nerve, which coils like a thick television cable back into the recess of the brain, impulses from the retina race along the fibers of the optic nerve, fan out into the brain and finally slam into the visual cortex, stimulating the miracle of sight. And you see because of that. And it's not that you have an image hitting the brain. The image never hits the brain. It's transmitted in a code form and going up all these wires into the brain, and you see two wires. Figure that out. The cortex is no easy task, since 1 billion messages a second stream in from the retina. I mean, that's a fast secretary we got up there. Only in the last few years have scientists gained a glimpse of how the visual cortex sorts out these electrical signals. A researcher opens up a cat's head, locates the visual cortex in the brain, and attaches an imaginably slender microelectrode to a single brain cell. Then the researcher places a variety of shapes and patterns of light and movement before the animal's eyes and meticulously records which object or pattern causes that particular cell to fire. The receptive field of a given cell is so specific that it may only fire when the cat is presented with a horizontal ball at a 30-degree angle. Some cells are excited by a large spot, some by a small spot. Some fire only in the presence of a ball of light in the center region of the field. If the ball is tilted 10 or 20 degrees, they will no longer fire. Some record a bright line moving on a dark background. Others record the boundary regions between light and dark. Some cells respond only to motion, and so forth. And through all of these, you're able to get all this understanding of things and motion. I can see my hand out here right now. I'm not even looking at it. I can see it moving. And motion and all types of things are happening by different ones are firing off. See, now it's really getting absurd to believe that all this came from inorganic, you know, through the organic, you know, protoplasm in a pool and through a rock, you know, and all the type of thing on up through. That'll take a lot more faith than to believe in a great mind and power and a creator creating such as we. The number of neurons responding successfully as the eye watches a slowly rotating propeller is scarcely unimaginable. As I read reports from the scientists who spend their lives mapping out the visual cortex cell by cell, I am most impressed by this fact when I see I am totally unconscious of the process of cells encoding data and firing, then uncoding and reassembling it within the brain. The fig tree outside my window with a swirl of butterflies comes to my consciousness not as a series of dots and light flashes, but as a fig tree whole and intelligible and complete with meaning. See, God has created all those things that come in the fashion of codes and all these other things and molecules, and He gives us a visual perception that we can see and smell and feel. We get a completely different picture. See, we're not getting the actual picture. That's why I have said so many times, you're not really seeing, you know, we're not really seeing things as they really are, so to speak, or hearing as they really are, but only as our teleceptors transmit them to us. God has we see things different than other creatures see them. And in the spirit realm, if you've got a spirit, you can see things and know things that you cannot know the other way. Like I said before, it's like a magnet. The metal knows the magnet there, the wood doesn't. One will fly to it, one won't. When God turns that magnet on, He's got enough metal in you, you'll fly to it. If you're made of wood, you won't. You're building metal, spiritual metal inside of you. And it isn't that God owes you anything. It's just whether you've got enough metal to find that magnet, so to speak. We need to understand that God has created us with an ability. If we are moving in a certain way, there is a spiritual world as well as a material world. These things happen in the material world. There is a spiritual world. We need to be more aware of the spiritual world. We need to begin, and we dare not let either demons or our own minds, which have been encoding, recoding, and all this of material things, so-called material things, we must not let that interpret the spiritual realm, because the spiritual realm is not material. And as long as you're trying to do that, you'll never really understand it. You're going to have to be able to sense it and understand it in the spirit. And many of you, I know, haven't got there yet. But you can and you will. Little babies, little infants, 2 weeks after birth, they can't walk. They can't walk. They can't touch their nose. They don't know what you're saying. They can hardly, and first they can't even hardly see you. But it's amazing what they learn, isn't it? Coming from the womb to an adult, it's amazing what has been learned. Well, it may seem like, oh, how am I ever going to come in touch with the spiritual world and become spiritual and understand this and this? Well, it's just like a little tiny infant. It's hard, but the one that stays in the environment, it learns. It learns. If you move in a spiritual environment, you'll learn. You'll learn. And if you don't, you won't. And when the time when God pulls out the latter rain and catches his people home, these type of things, either you have learned and moved in that realm or you haven't. But the will and the determination lies in each individual soul. The ability to transpose messages, transpose units of messages, whether from the ear, the nose, the tongue, or the eye, into the ever higher strata of meaning, is only possible because of the inner functions of the secluded brain. Cells inside that fortress have no immediate experience of light, sound, taste, or odor. Yet every bit of data transmitted by sense organs terminates there. Indeed, no sensation truly registers until the brain has taken hold of it, translated it, and made sense of it. Even the most experienced surgeon has difficulty with orientation in the brain. That means when going into it and finding out where everything is. For everything appears soft and white, like a blizzardy Arctic landscape. Brain surgery would still be in the primitive stage were it not for one remarkable discovery of science. When a surgeon inserts a needle-like electrode into a portion of the brain and switches on the current, the brain responds, indicating what function that area controls. And if he didn't have this ability to do that, he would still not know much about that brain, what the brain does. The brain itself has no sensations of pain or touch. So the patient will say something like, I feel a tingling sensation in my left leg if the surgeon lightly stimulates the surface of a particular lobe of the brain. He doesn't feel anything here. He feels it someplace else. Wilder Penfield, a brain surgeon in Montreal, has recorded bizarre results from such stimulation. While trying to locate the source of epileptic seizures, he found that in certain portions of the brain, he could electrically stimulate specific memories in sharp detail. One young South African patient began laughing, reliving second by second an incident on a farm in his native land. A woman recalled every note in a symphony orchestra she had heard long before. Catching a certain brain cell, trying to figure out, if he's hunting for something that might give him some clues about epileptic seizures, recall every single note in the whole symphony. See, her memory can't recall back that sharp, but it's all logged there, every note. And because she knows every note, he remembers everything happening when he was a child back there. The memory surged up such vivid detail for one patient on the operating table that she remembered sitting at a train crossing years before and could verbally describe each train car as it went by. Another counted aloud the number of teeth of a comb used in childhood. Often these memories from early childhood precede the patient's first conscious memory. You say, well, how could you? A child doesn't know how many is in a comb. No. But the eye has looked at each one, and it has registered, even the child isn't even conscious of it. It's registering things, millions of things, all the time, that you don't even know it's registering. All the time. Now, let me say this. This is why it's important what you watch on TV and that your children watch and in the movies and books and magazines and records and tapes, etc. The environment is important. It's being recorded uphill. And it has effects on one. By drawing on such techniques and by studying stroke victims, oh, such a familiar word. What kind of, anyway, people deal with the anatomy have been able to develop a fairly reliable map of the brain. Most brain research centers on the top layer of the brain, most top researchers centers on the top layer of the brain, the cerebral cortex, which is far more advanced in humans than any animal. The thickness of the sole of a shoe, the cortex contains neurons that sift, sort, collate, and process the information we perceive as sight, sound, touch, conscious brain behavior, and the higher activities of learning and memory. The bulk of a nerve cell population lies in that light layer of gray matter, the fertile topsoil on the brain. Now, I'm not reading you everything, of course. In the entire brain, only 1 in 1,000 cells report in from the extremities, from the limbs. All visual images... In the entire brain, only 1 out of 1,000 cells report in either from the extremities, from all visual images, all sounds you hear, all touch and pain sensations, all smells, the monitors of blood pressure, chemical changes, sensation of hunger, thirst, sex drive, muscular tension, all the noise from the entire body occupy only 0.1% of the brain cells. All the rest of it is something else. Each second, those fibers bombard the brain with 100 million messages. That's that little tiny part, 100 million messages per second. Now, the rest of it is receiving a lot more from something else. See, indeed, we're wonderfully and filthily made that will cause you to shudder in amazement. Of these few hundred at most, let's see, another 0.2% of cells control all motor activities, emotions involving playing a piano concert, speaking a language, dancing a ballet, typing a letter, operating a video game. In between these two groups, the way in and the way out, you know, that we see what you receive and what you give out, lies all others, enormous numbers of cells cooperating in a vast network of intercommunication to allow the processes we know as thought and free will. Brain biologist J.Z. Young likens the network to 10 billion bureaucrats constantly phoning each other about plans and instructions for keeping a country running. Unlike a telephone switchboard that connects single subscribers indirectly through a central switching station, each nerve cell in the brain has up to 10,000 of its own private lines. All along its length, dendrites reach out and form connections with other neurons, in effect linking each cell with wires from an entire city. It listens in for the patterns of impulses and the average rate of arrival and decides whether to continue the message by firing off chemicals along with thousands of other connections. Physiologically, the whole mental process comes down to these 10 billion cells spitting irritating chemicals at each other across the synapses or gaps. The web of nerve cells defies description or depiction. 1 cubic millimeter, the size of a pinpoint, contains 1 billion connections among cells. The mere gram of brain tissue may contain as many as 400 billion synaptic junctions. We're talking small. We think that either computer chips the size of a fingernail can do all this is amazing beyond belief. This is so much more complex and smaller than that, that it's way out of another realm. See, God is past finding out. Absolutely fantastic. Now, maybe you can begin to wonder why you can't always, with limited experience, sort out demonic reactions from self-reactions from the Lord and all these other things. We got so much happening up here. What is us and what's something else? We're complex beings. Therefore, there is great safety in following the word of the Lord and the laws of God. Because so much more is happening and affecting us in all kinds of ways than we realize. We say, oh, I won't be affected. I'll watch for this. Such naivety. When you really realize what's happening in the body and you really care, you become more important with yourself. As a result, each cell can communicate with every other cell at lightning speed. As if a population far larger than the Earth were linked together so that all inhabitants could talk at once. The brain's total number of connections rivals the stars and galaxies of the universe. We've been talking about a pinpoint and how much a pinpoint has. The total number rivals that of all the galaxies and stars of the universe. And everyone is communicating back and forth with every other one. Even in sleep, the nerve cell community never stops chattering. The brain is a turbulent cloud of electrical potentials. Only a few reach your level of consciousness. And though so quickly, we are hardly aware of the process. I decide to write the next sentence, and a flash, my memory completes the thought and then the words. I will use an elaborate coordination of muscles, tendons, and bone required to type the words. Before I finish typing, my brain begins composing the sentence to follow. This is all quite wonderful. So God has created man in his own image, fearfully and wonderfully made. And God said, it is good. And the Bible says that man was created a little lower than the angels. And they fall below Lucifer, and Lucifer fall below God. We don't have two almost even gods up there fighting. God is so far greater than the spirit-created being Lucifer. Lucifer is no threat to him. He's just allowing him for purposes of testing his people to commit themselves so they will love him and exercise that so he can have those that will love him. And when he's ready for Lucifer and his gang, he just flicks them off with his little finger and the Gehenna fire, and that's it. Now, all of this by evolution from a speck of cosmic dust becoming a little rock, then to protoplasm, to a fish, to a reptile, to a mammal, to an ape, to a man? I don't believe that. No way is right. Well, I've run out of time for my message, and I'm not done. But, I'll continue it. Wonderfully and fearfully made. And when I finish the message, and the message to follow, and I'll probably have another one this week, perhaps, finishing, we need to come to an understanding then that we should not go around thinking we are dust. See, demons want us to think that. When a man begins understanding, he is a temple of the Holy Spirit. And we haven't even addressed the spirit of the soul yet. And these people have no way, you know, of even getting into that field. We are truly fantastic beings, although we always tell us how dumbbells we be. I think most of our dumbbell status is demonic. In other words, even the dumb stunts we do, the wrong we do, I mean, we're just not being careful of the impulses. I think God is trying to get us to become more aware of who we are, what He has created, why He has created it, what happens to us in various environments, that there are different spirits that are seeking us, and we need to discern between them. We need to be careful of our environment. We need to appreciate what we are in God. We need to understand the power that He's given us in our spirits and in our souls, and the power to discern and make decisions as to whether what we do with the impulses that come from the body, what impulses come from the spirit. And I'm not through with my message, you understand, this is just an interlude at this time, so we're not through with the whole message. I think there's something here we need to get a hold of that will give us a greater appreciation and make us more careful in our lives.